As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the 3-0 show for Thursday, December 1st. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris, Katie Wu, Britt Giroli on much-deserved vacations. On this episode, we will recap what has been a pretty intriguing first month of transactions for the Major League Baseball offseason. A November recap that has featured a busier-than-expected Anaheim Angels club, so we'll talk about what their moves mean for 2023, what it might mean for the future of Shohei Ohtani, at least over the course of this winter. And then, of course, we'll dig into other moves. Jose Abreu is now a member of the Houston Astros. Mike Clevinger went to the White Sox. We've had a few trades that have come up over the course of the month. We'll kind of grade the moves so far and try to set the table for what's to come with the winter meetings on tap for next week. You know, I think the big question with the Angels is, is Shohei Ohtani more likely to stay on this roster at least through the first part of the season in the wake of the moves they've made so far? We talked a bit about, you know, Tyler Anderson signing a multi-year deal there on our last episode with Katie 2 weeks ago. They made the trade for Gio Urshela, and then they made another trade for Hunter Renfroe. So they've added quite a bit to this roster already, seemingly to get more competitive and to make a run at the postseason, with the Ohtani, Trout, Rendon trio all still in place for one more year.
I'm actually counting right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. This is really good radio, by the way. I just came on counting. But the Angels are now 20th in projected wins above replacement. That's how far they've risen in the ranks. But, you know, this it's not like the work is done. You know, I think that they could still find in their budget maybe something for a middle infielder. You know, between David Fletcher and Luis Renjifo, I think they might have a couple good backups. I mean, I like both those players, but for a team with championship aspirations, or at least getting to the postseason aspirations, I think they need something there. You know, going Ohtani, Anderson, Sandoval, Detmers, and then a fair amount of depth, actually, for a team that might have to go six deep in their starting rotation. I think they're doing pretty good in the starting rotation. I think the other last thing they would need is a stand-up reliever, a kind of closer, I think, with a capital C. Those two things are going to be expensive, middle infielder and closer. But the one thing that's nice about what they've done is they really updated their depth charts. They really made their depth better with both of these, with Anderson, Renfro, to a lesser extent, there, you know, Urshela, I think, as well. You know, Urshela could play second, could play short. You know, in a pinch, that could be their middle infielder. Maybe they don't have that much money to spend. But these are win-now moves. And I think that the idea might be that, you know, we have two of the best five players in baseball, or two of the best 10 players, however far you think Mike Trout has fallen. And we might as well go for it. And, you know, the new GM is probably saying, I want to go for it. I don't want to rebuild. And even the prospective ownership group doesn't exist yet. It is not one single entity. We don't have a prospective buying group that's ready to go yet. So I think at this point, the idea is we can get a lot for Shohei Ohtani at the trade deadline. We could probably get more now, but then we'd be sort of punting on the season. So let's try and win this season. And if it doesn't work out, we'll trade Ohtani at the deadline.
Right, because you've got this pretty rare opportunity with that much top-end talent. So I do like the moves they've made so far. As critical as I've been of the Angels over the last probably 2 to 3 years for lacking depth, for really struggling to put a complete pitching staff together, they're at least taking the right steps to do that. I'm 100% with you on the middle infield. I think if you are starting one of Luis Renjifo or David Fletcher every day at second base, and the other is sort of your backup infielder that can play up the middle, and you've got maybe Gio Urshela moving into more of a part-time role depending on the health of Jared Walsh or the possible addition of another maybe free, like lower-end free agent first baseman, suddenly this becomes a deeper position player group, and that's something they've really lacked in recent years. And I wonder if they could actually go out and get one of the big free agent shortstops, because given their needs and given how much they could improve at that one spot, you're talking about probably a 3 WAR increase in their projection if they were to go out and get maybe a Xander Bogaerts or a Carlos Correa. I mean, all those players have very competitive markets, but I wonder if the Angels can make one big push in free agency to get that last superstar in place at a position of desperate need. And I guess if they don't do that, what fallback options are there? Like, what sort of mid-range upgrades at shortstop even exist right now, either via free agency or more likely via trade?
I miscounted, so it was a really, really good opening. We are not at all rusty. But the Angels were 16th in projected WAR, actually. And if you did give them 3 wins like you just gave them, which is bold, but not unbelievable, if you gave them 3 wins on top of their current projection, they would go all the way up to 11th.
Yeah, see? Do it.
You know, 11th is in the playoffs. I don't think there is a great middle ground when it comes to middle infielders. It's kind of just how it goes because, you know, even Dansby Swanson to some, he's the fourth best, star. He's still going to cost $150 million. On the market probably. I behind him, when you're just looking at shortstops, the best answer is Elvis Andrus or Jose Iglesias, who are just, you know, stopgaps, very, 34, 33. They'd be the oldest shortstops out there if they played shortstop next year, either one of them. I think that would be a stopgap situation where they could do that. They could sign Jose Iglesias for $5 million and give themselves another option up the middle. They've done that before, but it's a go big or go home kind of market. I wonder if the Angels, with their setup right now, wouldn't be in the best situation to offer what the Twins offered Correa last year, which is something big on a one-year deal with opt-outs, Maybe one of these, free agents doesn't get exactly what they want in terms of the big dollar signs and the long deal, and they think that they can do better by taking a bunch of little smaller deals. Maybe Xander Bogaerts has to prove to people he can stay at short. You know, some people are already talking about moving him off of short. Well, if you want to prove to people you can stay at short, do the Carlos Correa thing. Take $35 million for 1 year, or 70 for 2 with an opt-out, that sort of deal. And play short again for another year. And get out of this 4 free agent mix, right? Somebody might do that.
Yeah.
Because there's 4 star shortstops right now, and one of them might not like the offers they're getting. And if they don't like the offers they're getting, they say, okay, well, the Angels are offering me $30 million for 1 year. I might take that.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty interesting way to think about it. I think the other paths via trade are, to me, less obvious. I know there were some rumblings that the Dodgers were interested in Willy Adames. That popped up a few days ago. I don't know how available he actually is. I think the decision to trade Hunter Renfroe to the Angels is more about the Brewers trying to counterbalance having a lot of arbitration eligible players that they want to keep and just finding a guy that they thought they could more easily replace with organizational depth given the young outfielders they have there. You start looking around other teams' depth charts, and most teams either have their long-term shortstop in place, their franchise guy. The teams that are looking are the other ones that the Angels are bidding against for these free agents. And then is there a team like Cleveland where maybe Ahmed Rosario is actually more available than people realize?
That was the team that I was. That's the one team that may have a surplus of shortstops because, you know, even when you look at their prospects and what they have coming up, Tyler Freeman and Gabriel Arias are both interesting shortstops. And Ahmed Rosario and Andrés Giménez can both play shortstop. So you've got four viable shortstops in one organization for next year. I think that the most likely trade partner, you know, trade situation there would be probably Ahmed Rosario because he is 1 year away from being a free agent and is due $9 million. So I think the Guardians would move Andrés Giménez over to shortstop and then fill second base with Owen Miller, Tyler Freeman, maybe a stopgap from the market that costs less than $9 million. That's not an impossible thing for the Guardians to consider. So yeah, Ahmed Rosario to the Angels. Let's or Xander Bogaerts on a $30 million 1 year deal.
I think it's a little trickier. The Bogaerts thing, as far as following the Correa path, he's 30 already. Correa did that, I think, at 27 last winter. So that could also make it more difficult for Bogaerts to do that. He also is one of the three players, along with Dansby Swanson and Trey Turner of this group, that have a qualifying offer attached. So to give up that draft pick compensation and potentially only have him for 1 year, that might be something that a team is reluctant to do. If you're looking for reasons why it couldn't happen or wouldn't happen, maybe those are the things to keep in mind. But I think Ahmed Rosario is someone that will start to pop up in more columns and trade rumor pieces and different things over these next few weeks because we know Cleveland has a lot of middle infield depth. They have some guys that are getting close to being big league ready, and we know they like to save money. So all the stars could align. I wonder what the Angels would actually give up. Would they continue trading young pitching? I know they've moved some arms, and in part because they just keep drafting pitching almost exclusively in recent years. They've actually built up some depth. But looking at that trade they made with the Brewers, did you like any of the pitchers going back to Milwaukee in that deal? Jansen Junk, Elvis Piguero, and Adam Semenaris, I think, were the three that went back. Semenaris, the only lefty of that trio.
Jansen Junk actually popped in the bottle, and appropriate to his name, it is his junk that is better than his fastball. His slider.
You mean secondary pitches, right?
Yes, that's what I mean. He has a junker.
Important point of clarity.
But his slider is his best pitch. It is near elite. I don't know. He was sort of in between starting and relieving. Maybe the Brewers push him to relief, where the fastball plays up velo-wise, and he's more of a good reliever, or they see something they can change in the changeup and curveball to make him a good pitcher despite a bad fastball. They've done that in the past with people like Eric Lauer, and they've had some success with also the hybrid sort of Brent Suter. They just lost Brent Suter. Jansen Junk could go in there and be a reliever that can also give them innings. So I kind of like that part of the deal. However, I would like to say that I'd like this deal on some better for the Angels, and it reminds me a lot of the Teoscar Hernandez to the Mariners deal, where what we're seeing now is that corner outfielders without that much defensive value, kind of maybe one-note corner outfielders on one year of contract, they don't bring back much in trades, and so that makes them actually, I think, a little bit of an undervalued asset in that you can send basically relievers. I mean, that's what both trades were. You send relievers, and there used to be a thing that there was no such thing as a relief prospect, people said, You found relievers. You. There were failed starters, and so on and so forth. Now you can send relievers and get a viable, above average corner outfielder for your reliever. I think do it, especially if you're a team that can that has shown some ability to make relievers. Now I'm not sure the Angels are that team yet, but they did just sign a director of pitching away from Driveline, Bill Hazel. Who is one of the better minds in pitching that, you know, I've talked to, really respect him, and they've done some other stuff under the hood in the past to improve their pitching development. So they might be a little better at replacing Jenks and Junk as they have been in the past.
Yeah, I think this is a lot like that Teoscar Hernandez situation, a player that hits the ball hard, someone that's probably 15 to 20% better than a league average contributor at the plate. That's a nice boost to have. If you're a team that can be maybe in the wild card mix and you currently have some weakness in left field, right field, or even in your DH spot, you're projecting for, you know, a win above replacement or something. You could get someone that's 3 or 4 wins above replacement for next to nothing via trade if you're willing to pay $10, $12 million, whatever the late stage arbitration price tag is. That's a small price to pay, relatively speaking, for a pretty big boost to your offense. And you're probably talking about a player that, if you are not actually in the wild card hunt come July, contending teams will trade for that player later because he is a good offensive player. So I think it works out really well, especially if you're a team that's not necessarily a front runner in the division, but also you have a shot at being competitive in the upcoming season.
Also, when Mike Trout is hurt, you can sneak Hunter Renfro to the plate and pretend you still have Mike Trout.
The resemblance is uncanny. It really is. They send Renfro out to sign autographs if Trout's not feeling well.
Trout and budget Mike Trout.
No, I like the move for the Angels. I think this is, in concert with the other things they're doing, a step in the right direction to be the team that a few of us thought they could be in 2022. And I imagine they're not done. I imagine they'll be active at the winter meetings as well.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Meanwhile, in the AL West, Jose Abreu lands with the Astros. A bit of a surprise to some that he got a third year. And I think reading some of the different reaction pieces around, you know, Keith Law had one on The Athletic, Ben Clemens had one at Fangraphs, opinions varied a little bit in terms of loving it. I think Ben was more on that side, and I think Keith was more on the side of the Astros probably overextended relative to what they're likely to get at the end of the contract for Abreu. All that is to say, I think I've thought this about free agents for a long time. You don't get bargains in free agency very often. Usually you are going to pay full price, and sometimes you're going to pay even more than what full price should be based on projections. If you're the Astros and you're looking at contending for the World Series each of the next 3 seasons, the final dollars for Jose Abreu don't matter. He makes your team better. And as a righty who hits the ball very hard and has good plate skills, I think he's going to fit in that ballpark really well, even though his approach tends to be a little more of an all-fields approach for a first baseman. This is not a pull-everything power bat. This is a guy that actually is a good all-around hitter.
Yeah, you know, over at Fangraphs, they had crowdsourcing has been pretty good in the past, and they had him for 2 years and $32 million, and I really liked him at that number. This number, you know, 3 years and $60 million is a lot higher than that. And in terms of what he's projected to do next year, you know, and over the next 3 years, It may be an overpay. Some quick math, which you usually do, is age a player a half win a year at his age. Actually, it might be a little bit more aggressive at 36, but let's just be generous. Age him a half a win. So next year, he'd be, the projection is for two and a half wins, basically. League average is two, right? So what you're saying is next year, he'd be above league average player. And then the year after that, he'd be a league average player. And the year after that, he'd be a below league average player. If you add all that up, basically, you get about, let's see here, you get one, three, four, six wins. And so they're paying $60 million for six wins. The average price for a win in the past was about $8 million, $8 to $9 million. You'd expect there to be inflation. There hadn't been inflation, probably because of some of the CBA situation, COVID, the shortened year. Maybe this is a sign that there will be inflation in the market this year and that teams will be willing to pay as much as $10 million a win for the top of the market. That might mean something for Aaron Judge. Or maybe it's just that they saw within the first base market, there were only two first basemen, maybe three if you count Josh Bell, that were projected to be league average or better. Anthony Rizzo re-signed with the Yankees. Maybe they didn't like Josh Bell as much. And so they were willing to give that extra $4-5 million, whatever it took, to make sure that Abreu was an Astro. But in terms of his performance on the field, you know, he's been 25-30% better than the league average with the bat all these years. He still hits the ball really hard. Only two players averaged a higher exit velocity last season. The run problem with him is that he's begun hitting the ball into the ground more. And his barrel rate has gone down. His power has gone down. That's part of why he only had 15 homers last year. He had his league, his career high in ground ball rate. And that is one thing that happens as you age. You hit more ground balls after your peak. So if there is a problem with Abreu, is that he'll be a little bit of an empty batting average where he hits for a pretty good batting average because he still makes contact. He'll have the OBP, but maybe the power is not going to come back. Still, that sounds very Michael Brantley-esque. So if he kind of replaces Michael Brantley as a righty in terms of making contact and hitting 15 to 20 homers a year, I think they'll be fine with the deal, even if they overpaid by $4 to $5 million. $4 to $5 million.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so the thing about overpaying in free agency, and I know this is not a video show for everyone, it is on the Athletic Baseball Show's YouTube page, is that when you grossly underpay players like Jeremy Peña, which is just the structure of Major League Baseball. This is not directed at the Astros. Mm-hmm. You can afford to throw a few extra million at Jose Abreu relative to what your spreadsheet says. That's how this works.
You remember what Andrew Friedman said? And he said, it's funny when people say these things and you're like, wow, you said that out loud. He said, if you never overpay according to what your analysts say or what your numbers say, you'll never get a free agent.
You know, people who've played fantasy baseball probably understand that too. Because if you've ever played in a salary cap draft, formerly an auction, if you've ever played in that format, people don't stick to the numbers on their sheet for the very best players. Everyone tends to go over those numbers for the best players. Free agency is a bit like that, where you have this limited number of players available. I think your point about the first base pool is really important here too, because if they didn't get Jose Abreu, and there were plenty of other suitors and the Padres, the Red Sox were among the teams rumored to be interested, and there are probably some others. The White Sox may have even wanted him back. They made an offer. If you look at those teams all competing, one of those three teams is going to get nothing in free agency as far as a above-average hitter at first base goes. Now, some of these teams have organizational replacements. The White Sox will play Andrew Vaughn at first base. But I look at Jose Abreu, and just looking at him at kind of a five-year snapshot of his offensive profile compared to the two outfielders we were talking about, Teoscar Hernandez and Hunter Renfro, Abreu strikes out quite a bit less than both of those players. He walks just as much as those guys. So you get a more balanced slash line, right? You get a 280s batting average, usually a 350-ish OBP and similar power, but you get a better offensive performance. And you get it at a position that's actually a little bit harder to find players like that. A lot of the players you can find at first base are platoon mashers. And then you got to use two roster spots to even maximize their value. So I do think this is a bit of an interesting supply and demand sort of thing with the Abreu specifically. That doesn't even mention some of the other factors that might lead a team to go the extra mile to get a player. I think he's a very likable teammate by every account, right? People are going to miss him in Chicago, and it sounds like he's going to be a great fit in Houston too. So I think they're going to be fine. Even if Jose Abreu is only good for 2 out of the 3 years, the Astros are going to be absolutely fine giving him that third year, because there's a good enough chance they win a World Series in one of the first 2 years that they won't even care what happens in 2025.
Yeah, and I wonder what's next for the Astros. A lefty outfielder would be interesting. And, you know, considering their Chaz McCormick, Jake Myers with an injured shoulder in center field, I mean, I know that's in his rearview mirror, but we haven't really seen the same Jake Myers post-injury. I think it might be interesting for them, a sort of high-variance outfielder that hits from the left side, Mr. Cody Bellinger. But would he join the Astros? He was pretty angry about that whole thing.
He was. It really depends on how he believes they might be able to help him. Like, it's got to be a factor, right? But the other factors here, if you're the Astros and your strength as an offense continues to be an ability to do damage while also putting a ton of balls in play up and down your lineup, this is a very difficult lineup to rack up strikeouts against. Just tough at bat after tough at bat. Does Cody Bellinger as a high K percentage bounce back candidate make sense for the way they're built? Or are they more likely to go maybe in the direction of like an Andrew Benintendi and try to actually find a bargain in free agency and say, yeah, actually, we think he can be kind of Brantley-esque for us in this park. And maybe he offers quite a bit more defensively than some of the alternatives out there, too. So you're making up some value on that side.
And they probably have the ability to spend, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now if they'll get Justin Verlander. If they get Justin Verlander, you know, I think they will be in the luxury tax, and I doubt that they will actually spend much more for another outfielder. I think they'll just try to make it work with Jake Myers, Chaz McCormick, Mauricio Dubon, and maybe some sort of, you know, lower tier outfielder that, or maybe even like a DH and play Yordan Alvarez, like maybe pick up like a Matt Carpenter and play Yordan Alvarez more in the outfield, that sort of deal. If they don't get Justin Verlander, I think Andrew Benintendi and Michael Conforto become more interesting players for them. Lefty swinging outfielders that won't strike out as much. So I do think they've got maybe $30 million that they could spend, and it kind of is either all in the Justin Verlander pile, or we get a couple of players that help us in the other pile. So that's an interesting decision for them going forward.
I just want Jim Crane, if he's going to have a larger say in the decision-making, to just keep throwing money at people.
Get Justin Verlander and Michael Conforto. There we go.
Just keep going. Just show us how rich you are. Just keep signing players. Just show off your money.
A bunch of money by making it to the playoffs. That's worth a lot, you know, going all the way through. That's a lot of gate receipts and jersey sales and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I would also say that the interest they have in Wilson Contreras seems legitimate, too. I mean, that made sense going back to the trade deadline last year, and we kind of later found out there were some conversations about possibly making that happen. Let's talk about Mike Clevinger going to the White Sox. I believe he was one of the players you wrote about in your recent free agent bargains piece. So what do you think about Clevinger heading to the south side of Chicago?
You know, that was another one where, you know, the crowd said 1 year and $8 million. The White Sox, you know, did 1 year and $12 million. I would say that this is evidence that perhaps the market's going to be more healthy than the projections have been, but it's not totally the case. The CrowdSource projections had $44 million for Tyler Anderson. He went for 39. They had 39 million over 3 years for Martin Perez. I guess he kind of beat that in a 1 year deal for 19 million. But Nick Martinez, the crowd said 2 for 16. He went 3 for 26. They're not that far off. And I don't know if I should make a big deal about $4 million, but once you get to 1 year and $12 million, you do put yourself in the running for some other kind of maybe better pitchers. Corey Kluber is going to be at that 1 year and $12 million range. You may find that Jameson Taillon may take something like that if he doesn't want the three-year deal. You might be able to get Sean Manaea to give you a one-year, $12 million deal to reestablish some of his value. You know, there's just a little bit better. Andrew Haney could even take 1 year and $12 million. So there's, you know, there are pitchers out there that I would rather have for 1 year and $12 million because Clevenger still has a good slider, but no other pitch of his really rated as above average by Stuff Plus. And his second best pitch is his cutter. I don't know if he can really just become a cutter slider guy. So there's some velo that he left on the table, on the operating table. And I'm waiting for him to get that back. And it's not the easiest thing to coach back up. You know, I love Ethan Katz as a coach in Chicago, but, it's not like he can just be like, hey, throw harder.
He could, but I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, right.
Probably not the best, advice that he could give in isolation. But I think with Clevenger, the question most people are going to have is how much more can Stuff return another year removed from Tommy John? If you go back to the 4 years, 2017 to 2020, the 4 years before Clevenger was hurt, he was a top 20 starting pitcher by WAR. The problem, I think, is that when you are in that group for a four-year stretch, you're not usually there for the next four-year stretch because of injuries, because of lost velocity, because of all the things that just happen as a pitcher ages. Is it reasonable to expect a little more of a recovery going through a completely normal offseason this winter? If he gets a tick back, does that change a lot or a little for Clevenger and his 2023 outlook?
I mean, I have to say, it sounds reasonable. And I think the stakes are fairly low for the White Sox in that, you know, Clevenger slots in as their four or five, depending on the health of Michael Kopech's knee. And so, you know, even if he isn't that great, you know, he'll be okay. He's their fifth starting pitcher. It's a one-year deal. Don't make a big deal out of it. On the other hand, I will just have to say that the research suggests that your stuff comes back quicker than your command. And so, you know, the fact that he's down almost two ticks from, he's down two ticks from where he was healthy before surgery. I wouldn't predict that he gets those two ticks back.
It sounds like this is a move that you're kind of neutral on. Kind of a, if you're grading it A to F, what are you throwing on that?
It's fine. I mean, like, you send 1 year and $12 million to Corey Kluber, you have the downside risk of injury and sort of all the miles on his arm, right? So, and you know, maybe some of those other guys that I mentioned, Taillon, you know, Manaea, a lot of those guys are projected for 2 years. So maybe they'll get 2 or 3 years and then they'd rather have that, the security, than 1 year deal. So maybe this is where the market's at. And he could get some of his stuff back. And if not, he's an okay fifth starter.
Yeah, I think I would log this as probably a slightly better than average kind of move. I actually feel like it's a gamble worth taking for the White Sox, and I think it could work out for him in the back end of that rotation. One trade that went down that I don't think we've had a chance to discuss: Kyle Lewis goes to the Diamondbacks, Cooper Hummel goes back the other way, kind of a catcher utility player, and it sounds like the Mariners like him enough to catch him at least a little. Obviously, they have Cal Raleigh as their primary catcher, and Raleigh is going to handle a ton of that workload behind the plate. But let's start with Lewis, a guy that's really battled injuries throughout his entire professional career. When we've seen him on the field, is Kyle Lewis still showing us enough of a power ceiling to remain intriguing, health permitting?
He's actually underperformed his batted ball rates in the way. What I mean is that he has a very high barrel rate. He's hit the ball hard in the right angles for power, and yet the best we've seen out of him is basically like a 20-22 homer pace, maybe 25 homer pace in 2020 in the shortened season. So, you know, he has the barrel rates of somebody who could hit 30 homers. So he has that power in him. That's very exciting because he pairs it with some ability to make contact in his better years, some patience. You know, overall, I think we haven't necessarily seen the best season that we could see out of him in terms of quantity and quality, right? So they're making a bet that a little bit like Ketel Marte, where, you know, this is a guy who can hit the ball hard And we haven't seen his best yet, and we're going to take advantage of that. On the other hand, you know, nobody's more in tune or more aware of Kyle Lewis's health and his knees and his ability to provide positional value, to provide any sort of defensive value than the Mariners, who could have used a bat down the stretch and chose to leave him in the minor leagues. And so when I saw that, I thought, this guy's not going to be a Mariner for much longer. Cooper Hummel is a guy that barrels the ball, does not swing at balls outside the zone, and has had trouble making contact at the major league level, but had better contact rates in the minor leagues. In some ways, he's a similar bet that he has better days in front of him with the bat, and can also help them somewhere defensively.
I think that's a big part of it with Lewis, is that I think the Mariners, they already have Jesse Winker. Winker's coming off of two pretty significant injuries. They didn't really have the luxury of trying to let Kyle Lewis figure it out as a DH, whereas when you look at the Arizona depth chart, we know they've got a ton of outfielders. Most of them are lefties, right? When you look at Corbin Carroll and Dalton Varsho and Jake McCarthy and Alec Thomas, they are all left-handed hitters. And if you look at their DH position chart, I mean, Christian Walker's the first baseman, so you're not really worried about him taking a ton of the time at DH. DH was sort of a floating spot. Pavin Smith, part of that too, another lefty. So Kyle Lewis, I think, could emerge as a legitimate everyday DH if everything goes right in Arizona. And I don't think that path really existed for him in Seattle, where they have higher expectations and they would have needed him to play more in the outfield.
And they also traded for Teoscar Hernandez, right? So, you know, even if Jesse Winker, you know, gets healthy and plays better in the outfield, then they still have another guy who could play DH, and Teoscar Hernandez is not, he's not a very good defensive outfielder. So they have two guys already that they kind of want to use in that DH spot. So yeah, 100% I'm with you on that analysis. And you know, for Arizona, it could end up being a steal. You know, honestly, if he can hit 25 homers and strike out 22% of the time and walk 10% of the time, then he's going to be like 25% better than the league average with a bat. And that's going to be better than Pavin Smith or Emmanuel Rivera or whoever else, or Cooper Hummel, honestly, in their DH spot in Arizona.
Could be one of those minor trades that you look back at a year from now and say, that actually worked out for both sides. Both teams got a little bit better where they needed to be with the swap that they made in November. Jamer Candelario signs with the Nationals. You want playing time as a free agent? Sign with the Nats. They got plenty of playing time up for grabs. How do you feel about this as a rebuilding team kind of going after not an old guy by any stretch, almost a younger sort of player that was more available than people might have expected a couple of years ago? I mean, it looked like Jamer Candelario was possibly part of the Tigers' core maybe 2 years ago, and now he's going to D.C.
Yeah, I actually think the Tigers made a poor decision of non-tendering him. It was only $7 million, and Candelario had a pretty good track record of being able to put up good on-base percentages with better-than-league average power. I mean, he had 2 years in a row where he was 20% or better with the bat. So I think he'd sort of proven he should have given himself more, you know, leash, as they say, by what he did in 2020 and 2021. And so I'm a little, I think the Tigers made a poor decision there. What I like about this for the Nationals is that this is a little bit more in the Joey Meneses category than it is in the, Alcides Escobar category, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a bad team, you have the precious resource, which is playing time. Like you said, you have this opportunity that you can give people. And this is something that the A's do almost better than anybody, right? When they're bad, they just cycle through players. They just pick up players off of waivers. They just give everybody chances. And then maybe you get Seth Brown and you don't ever remember the other guys they tried because they just move on. They got their Seth Brown and they do it again with their other positions and they get somebody new. And then they look up and they're over 500 and they're making the playoffs. So the Nationals, when they had Alcides Escobar out there was no chance that Alcides Escobar was going to play himself into any trade value or any future value for the team. Jaime Candelario is more like Joey Meneses in either he, you know, recovers. He made some poor swing decisions last year and chased more than he had in his past. If he just recovers that ability and goes back to being, you know, a steady 20% above league average third baseman that can actually play third. He's not a great third baseman, but you know that around playoff time, there will be a team that says, man, we were figuring it out at third, and it'd be much better if we had an actual, you know, third baseman that could hit. Maybe Eugenio Suarez gets hurt or takes a step back. You know, maybe the Marlins decide they would rather have somebody than Joey Wendell. You know, they have a good season there. You know, I don't know, you know, there's plenty of situations where maybe Josh Donaldson's hurt for the Yankees, you know, the Giants right now at third base have David Villar and Wilmer Flores and JD Davis at the top of their group. So there's a lot of places that if they're contending could say, hey, we want Jaime Candelario. And at the very least, it's a bounce back candidate that maybe, who knows, maybe they sign him, but you know, it's a better use of plate appearances than Alcides Escobar.
Yeah, I thought the addition of Stone Garrett by the Nationals also made a lot of sense. They have playing time up for grabs in their outfield. You look at what Garrett's done at AAA. He's shown power. He's shown speed. A 23.9% K rate in the PCL probably is a concern, especially if you're not a double-digit walk rate sort of player, because against big league pitching, that K rate's going to be probably closer to 30%. But there's power and speed. There's plenty of playing time available in the outfield, and from an offensive profile perspective, it's a little bit like Adelis Garcia, and you think about the value that Garcia is providing the Rangers right now. If you can take some of those tools and put them on the field for even a half season to see if you've caught lightning in a bottle, I think that's a gamble worth taking. So I actually like both of these moves for the Nats, given what they're doing right now and given that the bulk of the young prospects they traded for are still, you know, not quite ready to try and push them to their next competitive window.
Not a single one of the outfielders in Washington are projected to be, at least the outfielders at the top of the depth charts right now, Victor Robles, Lane Thomas, Josh Palacios, none of those guys are projected to be league average players next year. And in fact, with Robles and Palacios, they're not even projected to give you one win. So they're very close to replacement players at this point. And so Stone Garrett could easily replace one of them. Now, I thought, you know, worst case scenario, he's a righty. You know, maybe he makes more contact against lefties and he could slot in a platoon with Lane Thomas. But, you know, he did have reverse platoon splits in the minor leagues last year, Stone Garrett. That doesn't really matter. You wouldn't project a guy to have reverse platoon splits. That takes something like thousands of plate appearances to believe. So I would say, I would just put Stone Garrett in one of those positions and give him full-time playing time and do the kind of Joey Meneses thing where it's like, let's just see what you've got, kid. Like, let's give you a full season. If he can strike out 25% of the time and hit for power and be speedy and play good defense, then it won't matter that he doesn't walk. And he could play himself into a regular playing time. And I know there's people who follow prospects who think that Jake Alou is the guy there in Washington. And I do love Alou's combination of power and contact. And I do think that Alou is going to be there soon. He was in AAA last year for 242 plate appearances. He's 25 years old. There's room on this roster for Jake Alou and Stone Garrett, dude. I mean, you could, there's still room on this roster. I think center, I'm not sure that Garrett or Alou play center. I think you could put Lane Thomas and Victor Robles in a platoon in center and still play Stone and Alou on the corners and still have DH to play with. So, you know, you can like Alou and Garrett and think that this team offers opportunity for both.
Yeah, it's still not a crowded depth chart in DC. Yeah. So if you have someone that you like in the upper levels of that system, they're not blocked. They can earn an opportunity relatively easily compared to a lot of other depth charts around the league right now.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paulo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Men of the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Men of the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Let's go lightning round on the rest of these moves. Carlos Santana to the Pirates, who also added G-Man Choi and Luan Diaz in recent weeks.
I saw one model that said Carlos Santana is one of the top 10 players that would benefit from the new shift rules. And so, you know, you have a Pirates team that has added a couple players in G-Man Choi and Carlos Santana that do pull the ball along the left side. You know, so that's two players that might benefit from the new rules that weren't very expensive and that make this team better. You're starting to see, I think, in Pittsburgh, a positional core come together. O'Neill Cruz is an elite prospect. Could be Aaron Judge at shortstop. I mean, that's the comparison when you look at, you know, contact rates as a possible flaw, but also the quality of batted balls, the size, you know, the defensive ability. Cabrian Hayes is a core piece, even if he doesn't have the power. Brian Reynolds is a core piece. So now you're starting to put pieces around those core pieces. They've got a core catcher coming up through their minor league, you know, situation. So really now the onus is on their pitching team. It's now time for their pitching team to start producing some wins. Roansy Contreras, Yajure, Michael Burrows, Luis Ortiz. There's some stuff to really like there too. So I actually think this Pirates team is on the rise, and I see a lot to like here.
Yeah, I thought I saw something that said the Carlos Santana contract, like a 1 year, just under $7 million deal, was the largest free agent contract the Pirates have been out since the 2 year deal to Dan Hudson.
Oh God!
It was like 2-11, 2-11.5.
But that's a little unfair because
they shouldn't be throwing money at free agents in the last four to five years, relatively speaking, in terms of like big contracts.
Also, I'm sure there were some like arbitration and extension type contracts in there, right?
Yeah, it was a funny stat though.
Yeah, they're paying Brian Reynolds $13 million and.
I just thought it was a funny stat, though, in the sense that we talk about teams taking gambles, even like the Mike Clevenger contract with the White Sox and the Pirates for such a long time back in the, the Ray Searage pitching coach days were the place you could go on a pillow deal, on a 1 year contract and try and kind of reestablish your market for the long haul.
Quintana I just don't know. Yeah. But yeah, they're not spending. And I think that, you know, if you look at their historical trends, they used to put during the Andrew McCutchen years, they had $100 million rosters, and you know, in today's game that'd be $120-130 million, I think. So I do think that as this team starts to get better, they will spend a little bit closer to the $120-130 million level that they've shown in the past. That's their ability to do. I think you're also right that why spend $120, $130 million when the core is just not good enough to support it? So as this core gets better and shows them, shows improvement, they're going to do more of these $8, $10, $15 million deals.
I also think it's challenging to find players that want to come play for you in a big rebuild. If you have a chance to choose where you go for one of the only times in your career, do you want to go to a team that's projected to be bottom of the standings, or do you want to go somewhere at least with a shot to go to the playoffs? I think that's also a factor that leads to multi-year trends like this too. Obviously, spending is still a choice, but you do need people interested in playing for a team during a period to bring in quality players like that. Let's talk about Brent Rooker for a moment. Claimed off waivers by the A's, just a another masher, another guy tumbling through the depth chart that could stick, could be the next Seth Brown, could be off the roster by the middle of May if it doesn't work out.
Yeah, man, that they haven't even put him. Well, they have put him on the depth chart here on Fangraphs as the fourth. The fourth left fielder, behind Clint Capel, Tony Kemp, Cal Stevenson. That doesn't seem like much of a chance, but he has barreled the ball in the past. He doesn't make great contact, but he is kind of that three true outcome kind of guy. Walks, strikeouts, and homers. He still has a chance to be maybe a DH type for them. And right now at DH, they're showing Shea Langeliers and Sean Murphy as the number one and two DHs. And those guys are catchers. You don't want to play them at DH too much. So I would actually slot Brent Rooker in as one of their DHs right now.
I actually think there's a very good chance we see Sean Murphy on another roster in 2023 because he'll bring back a lot for the A's via trade.
They need help up the middle. I know Kevin Smith showed a little bit of life in the minors last year, but I don't know if he's necessarily a shortstop. Nick Allen doesn't have the bat. They've been cycling through guys like Diaz. What's his first name? Jordan Diaz. I didn't think Jordan Diaz had the glove for second. I didn't think Jonah Bride had the glove for second. He came up as a first baseman. So they really need some help up the middle on the infield. And I think, trading Murphy is about the only way to get that right now.
How about Shelby Miller going to the Dodgers? Big league deal, too. $1.5 million. Is he the latest Dodgers scrap heap reclamation project?
I know people with other teams that were, analytics people with other teams that were pushing to sign him. That is why it took $1.5 million. It was not a minor league deal or a $500,000 deal. I know I have a stuff metric that looks at the physical shapes of pitches, the shapes and velos of the pitches. He was the best reliever available by Stuff Plus. Now it was only 130 pitches or so, but that is a metric that's designed to be useful in small samples. It is why the Dodgers gave him $1.5 million. You wouldn't give him $1.5 million based on the results he had last year. So, the only worry for me is that, it is the type of pitcher that should have high platoon splits. He may not be a guy that you want to play against lefties a lot, and the rules next year will favor lefty batters. He's maybe what you call a roogie. It doesn't really exist anymore because of the rules. It's a righty one-out guy. You have to get three outs now, but back in the day, you used to have roogies. He's the guy, kind of guy that I would really want to hide against lefties. Still, very useful. Not a closer necessarily, but every spot on your roster can be good. And if you're the Dodgers, you can spend $1.5 million on a spot on the roster where everyone else is trying to spend $500,000.
Yep, you have that luxury because you are the Dodgers. You got those deeper pockets. Let's get to a mailbag question before we go. This one came from Matt in Reno. Matt was watching the Cardinals-Phillies series during the postseason. It seemed like a matchup of incredible defense on the Cardinals side versus an amazing offense and a much maligned defense on the Phillies side. And it felt like the ball was not hit to Nick Castellanos all series, which made Matt think about the randomness of balls in play. When calculating offensive and defensive war, a batter will see typically 4 to 5 plate appearances in a game no matter what, while a fielder may go 3 games in between defensive chances. Is this randomness somehow baked into defensive war, and does it make offensive contributions somewhat more valuable come postseason time?
That's a tough one. He's absolutely correct that defensive metrics are working with less sample. It's even worse than he puts it because when you're at the plate, we get a lot of information from every plate appearance. Every plate appearance, you give us more information, and then you give us 600 plate appearances of information. That's useful. All of it's useful. We can tell you something after 50 plate appearances. After 50 plate appearances, I can tell you how good you are at not swinging at balls. I can tell you how good you are at making contact. After 100 plate appearances, I can start to tell you how good you are at making powerful contact. So we had a lot of information from you at the plate. Out in the field, certain positions might get 200, 250, 300 chances over the full season. And of those 300 chances, 100, 150 might not tell us anything.
Right. Maybe routine chances.
Either routine or you had no chance. You know, there was that. That was a scream. That was a homer. That was a screaming line drive. That was a can of corn, you know. And so we're always looking at now the way that it's baked into war is by regressing and trying to compare and trying to make the most out of the numbers that you're given. And there's different statistical tricks you can play to make the most out of a smaller sample. So it is baked into war that way. But then you have to just look on the higher level and just be like, how valuable is defense on the higher level? And then you use that to weight it in war. So it's also not baked into war in that you'll just have players that look better according to war or worse according to war on 1 year based on just a couple balls going the wrong way, a couple drops. And so that is one of the biggest sort of weaknesses in war. There's nothing that can be done about it. It's just a fact that we're not as good at valuing defense. So yeah, somebody like Castellanos next year could just be a tiny bit better on defense and see, and I predict in fact that he will have one of the two or three biggest swings in war from this year to next year. He will be one of the, he is talked about for bounce back player of the year because he was the second worst Major League regular this year by war. I think he had minus three war or something, -0.3 war. A lot of that was that defensive value. So if he just makes any sort of defensive adjustments, he tries a little bit harder and balls bounce a little bit better for him, he could easily be a 2-3 war player next year.
Yeah, it's a huge swing for a guy that was, you know, -0.7 war this season. If he's two and a half above, it's a 3 war swing. Just from offensive contributions alone, even if the defense is the same, but if it gets slightly better because of variance, then you get even more of an impact in that final result. Matt also wanted to chime in that he'd love a running update from you, as it's his dream to name you as his favorite runner on a running podcast someday.
Oh, that would be great. I've had two sinus infections, a sprained toe and a sprained knee all in the last 2 months or so. And so I've run through them, which was not fun. But I was trying to make my goal of 800 miles on the year, and I will probably make it. I'm going to run past 740 today, and I've got a month left. So I'm on pace to make that. And I ran the half marathon in 2 hours and 6 minutes. So I made that goal that I ran the half marathon this year. The one goal I didn't make was a pace-related goal. I wanted to run 5 miles in under 8 minutes a mile. I didn't get anywhere close because I switched my training to running slow. So I kind of did a different training, but we'll see if I want to do that next year, or if I want to run 1,000 miles next year.
Going further, got to get a shoe upgrade going.
Yeah. All right. Can I get a shoe sponsor? Those things. I'm now to the point where you're supposed to buy them every 300 to 400 miles. So I'm buying multiple shoes a year. Having a shoe sponsor would save me some cash.
Yeah, we're here. You know, you can always reach out to us. RatesandBarrels@theAthletic.com. We'll be sure to pass it on to the ad
Saucony,
team.
I'm a Saucony guy.
All right. Well, hey, you might have to be a, I don't know, Asics, Nike, Adidas, something else kind of guy, depending on who comes calling, if anyone comes calling. But thanks a lot for that email, Matt, and hopefully everybody is fully up to speed now on Eno's running situation, which frankly I got to give you credit, because a lot of people not feeling well quickly bail on running. I am one of those people. If I feel under the weather, I'm not out there running. I don't push myself through it because I'm soft like that. But that's going to do it for this episode of the 3-0 show. We've got a special going right now at theathletic.com/baseball show. It's $2 a month for the first 12 months if you sign up for a subscription to The Athletic. So be sure to get that while you can. On Twitter, you can find Eno at Enoceris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show returns next week for the winter meetings.
We've always got the green light here.